Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker.
Raising teenagers in a networked world raises some new and interesting questions for parents.
Concerns about cyberbullying and online predators, as well as how social media might affect teen behavior and development.
But the internet and social media sites may not be as bad or as dangerous for teens as some people might think. That's the argument anyway from a new book out tomorrow. It's called It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens.
Dana Boyd is a principal researcher at Microsoft Research and a fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. She spent 8 years talking with teens across the country to try to get a better understanding of why and how they use social media. Some of their answers may surprise you. Hi, Dana. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, what do you think? There's no escaping social media in today's teenage world or world in general. Is social media largely something positive for teens, or is all this screen time harming our kids in the way they interact and the way they perceive the world? And teenagers, what do you think? Do adults understand your online life or not? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Now, Dana, let's start with you and so we can tell folks a little bit more about what your book is about. And you can correct me if I have the main argument wrong here, but I'm thinking that what you're saying is that social media offers teens more positives than negatives in a way. What are some of the benefits?
Teenagers turn to social media because they want to hang out with their friends. It's their equivalent of the mall when I was growing up, or you know, the dance hall even further back. It's the place where they know their friends will be. And so they engage, you know, in the ways that teenagers have always engaged. They socialize, they hang out, they joke around, they gossip, they flirt, all of this. And what it means is that, you know, just as most teens have always been okay, they're also almost always okay online. And they're playing out that environment because, in many ways, adults have taken away their face-to-face opportunities to get together in person. And so I think it's a very funny dynamic where, you know, parents have been so anxious about the physical world that, you know, they've created this environment that young people have turned to the online world to, you know, find a place of their own.
But isn't it a very different thing to relate to someone online and to relate to someone in person? And certain behaviors might be more acceptable. It might be easier to dehumanize someone online than certainly it is to do it. And it may take more courage to say certain things in person than online. So there's a difference there.
In theory, yes. But most young people are turning online to interact with the people that they see every day at school. These are the people that they already know. And by and large, they'd much rather get together in person, face to face. But they rarely have that opportunity in an environment that's not heavily structured. And so given any other choice, they're like, oh, well, we'll at least use the internet. Now, are things different? Sure. You know, things get mirrored and magnified, right? Some things spin out of control in unexpected ways. Conversations that, you know, would have gotten resolved pretty quickly if everybody was present suddenly get misinterpreted online. But it's also one of the challenges because young people have to learn how to negotiate this digital world. It's with them, you know, even into adulthood. So I think part of it is to realize that, you know, young people coming of age have to learn to negotiate all of the worlds that are around them online and off.
Okay, we have parents calling, interested to ask your opinion. Karen is calling from West Roxbury, and she would like your opinion of Instagram. Her 12-year-old daughter is asking for Instagram. Her friends apparently have Instagram. Karen, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call, and I look forward to reading the author's book, which I've been hearing bits and pieces about. And, my call's about Instagram. It's something that seems very popular in the tween and teen world, and something that my daughter wants. We've been discussing it. She's a responsible social media user thus far, but I just, you know, am doing due diligence as her parent and wonder what your opinion of it is.
Okay. Dana, Instagram for Karen's 12-year-old daughter. What do you think?
Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling in. You know, Instagram's tricky because technically, you know, the age limit on it is 13. So I have to first acknowledge the fact that under 13 is not technically allowed to be using the site. That says, as your daughter well knows, most of her peers are probably on this on the app anyhow. The dynamics of Instagram are not really about the service itself, but about how her friends are really using it. Are her friends using it just to sort of joke around with each other? Are they creating protected accounts? How are they negotiating this? Are they using it to put up images that are funny and fun, or are they using it for more sexualized images? I think my best advice to you is to really talk to your daughter, talk it through with her about what she wants to use it for, how she's going to think about it, and make certain that you're constantly in conversation with her. I think this is going to be challenging for you, at the age of 12, but even as she gets older, and it's really going to be dependent on how she's trying to fit in with her peer group, and what it means to be cool within her particular peer group.
Okay, so parents should have conversations with their kids about what they're doing online. Should they monitor? Should they have kids' passwords? I remember interviewing a pediatrician not all that long ago who said, absolutely, nothing online should be taboo from parents. If it's taboo, it's not a good sign. You should have complete access to what they're doing. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
So the challenge with surveillance is that surveillance undermines trust. And one of the things I kept hearing from teenagers all over the place is they would come to me like, why does my mom not trust me? She feels the need to look at everything I do. Am I such a bad kid? What's going on? And I think this is where it becomes difficult, because what you want as a parent is you want trust. Trust will get you through the hardest of the hard years. Now the question is, how can you actually get trust while giving young people some level of space? One of the pieces of advice I've often given is what I call the piggy bank solution. And the piggy bank solution is a very simple, household technique, which is that, as a parent, go and buy one of those old piggy banks, the kinds that actually have to be broken in order for you to get access to it. Make it, unique and fun, and make it a household object. And everybody in the household put their password in it. Put the date on the note with the password. So if you change your password, you just put in a new piece of paper. And then if you need to get access, break the piggy bank. And anybody in the house could break the piggy bank and get access to it. And what it ends up serving as is as a symbolic moment of saying, hey, we trust each other, but if there's an emergency, we always have access.
Mm. But certainly there are dangers. And if we talk especially about a site like an Instagram site where there's a lot of photo sharing, we've heard a lot of stories about sexting where, teenagers may send a picture that may be sexualized and it can get quickly disseminated and people are shamed because of it. And obviously parents have some responsibility to try to protect their kids from getting into a very deeply shameful situation. It's because of, I think, the speed and the volume by which information like that can move so quickly. What should parents do?
So the challenge is, of course, they have got a responsibility to help their child get through this. But the key is actually to figure out how to have that young person make certain that they can navigate it in a healthy and responsible way. Sexualized images are certainly a challenge, especially for young women in this country. And part of it, of course, is that they're seeing sexualized images from celebrities everywhere. And they're responding and mimicking a whole set of cultural artifacts that are all around them. This is also one of the reasons why, the moment we start seeing those images, we need to be having conversations about them. So when Miley Cyrus puts up, a video that is, overly sexualized, how do we actually converse with our young girls about what kind of images are okay, what are not, what is seen as cool? And it's a really tricky, set of issues, because as parents, we can see the traces through a lot of these online media, but there's a lot more going on, below that surface. And what we need to do is address, what's happening at the sort of baseline level, so that what comes out and what's made visible is not so deeply problematic. And a lot of it really comes down to status. It comes down to getting attention. So how do we have a conversation from the get-go about young people and how they're trying to actually get attention? Right. Is it done in a healthy way? Is it not? How do you deal with sexuality? When you're starting to see sexualized images, you need to start having a conversation about sexuality. And nothing is more uncomfortable for most parents.
Right. So parents should keep an eye sort of on what their kids are doing online, or and but not get into the whole password and knowing everything about it, or how, you know, how do you walk that line?
I mean, and it's different per child, and it's different at different ages, right? So when you're talking about a six-year-old, of course you're sitting there next to the, you know, your child going through every single thing that they're doing. In fact, you know, otherwise why are they engaging at all? As they are going into high school, you're dealing with a different kind of letting go. And I think this is where it's a transition process. And that transition really depends on your child's maturity, their comfort with their friends, how, you know, what kind of problematic activities they get themselves involved in. And you have to set boundaries, you have to set norms, but it becomes a conversation. And in that way, like, stop thinking about technology as the thing that is unique and think about how we have those conversations with our children writ large. So it's really about how do you help them work through it and not use surveillance as the cheat. Because I think this is where it becomes difficult with technology. Often parents come in and they think that if they surveil it, they can fix it, rather than actually realizing how important those conversations really are.
All right, listeners, we're talking with Dana Boyd. She's a principal researcher at Microsoft Research and a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. We're talking about teenagers' online lives, and Dana says that maybe they're not as bad or as dangerous as we've been led to believe. If you'd like to contribute to the conversation, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Dana, you were just making an interesting point, I think, and that is sort of the, I think, the difference between what adults think might be happening online and what young people think might be happening online. And in your book, you brought up this story that actually was on NPR of a young woman talking about her online journal and her mom reading that online journal. And although she was posting her feelings openly online, she wanted to do that, but she didn't want her mom to read what she was posting online for everyone else to read. So let's listen to a little bit of this clip right here. It's a piece by Bly Loretano Warner, and she's talking with her mother about her online journal. Let's listen.
You publish it. It's for general viewing. Therefore, I feel I'm part of the general public, so I could view it.
My mom always uses the excuse about the internet being public when she defends herself. It's not like I do anything to be ashamed of, but a girl needs her privacy. I do online journals so I can communicate with my friends, not so my mother can catch up on the latest gossip of my life.
So that's from an NPR piece with a teen talking about her mom reading her online journal. Dana, she doesn't want her mom to read that journal, yet she is posting the information in public, isn't it? So what's the difference there, and what are adults maybe not getting?
So as adults, we have the freedom to go out and be in public with a lot of freedom and flexibility to go wherever we want. We may choose to go to a bar, and we hang out with our friends, and we talk about our days at work, and we talk about all that was going on. That doesn't mean we wanted our boss to listen in on every conversation. For young people, their primary place where they can go and gather with their friends after school is online. And in the early days that Bly was talking about, a lot of it was about making things really visible, because otherwise, how could you connect with your friends? What's been interesting is that over the decade in which I've been studying young people's engagement with privacy online, they've become a lot more sophisticated. And instead of trying to actually limit access to content because they know that their mom could always look over their shoulder, what they've started to do is encode a lot of what they're sharing online. So they'll write using song lyrics, but only their friends know exactly what's going on. They'll use pronouns, but only their friends know exactly who's being referred to. And you start to see young people being very sophisticated because they want privacy in public. And it's a really challenging thing to try to negotiate.
Right. It's also really hard, I think, for the adults to know exactly what's going on, because kids have an online persona that may not be who they are in real life.
Well, I wouldn't say that's not who they are. They're trying to figure out who they are, and they're trying to figure out how they can be seen as cool. But what's cool to mom is very different than what's cool to your friends. And so parents often misinterpret what's happening because they project onto it. They assume they understand based on the literal interpretation of what they see, but it's often not the whole story. And young people are really trying to deal with many contexts simultaneously, and that's very difficult to negotiate.
So, yes, it is complicated. Let's go to a listener. Tony is calling from Everett. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I just have a quick comment. I don't know about a lot of the research that's been done, but I just heard somebody say that we shouldn't necessarily ask our kids' passwords in social media, and I have to say I strongly disagree. I'm not an expert. I'm just a mother, but I'm a mother of three, and I have two teenage girls that still have no social media, and I have a son who's a sophomore in college who got it in high school, and I felt like the best thing to keep them safe was to know their passwords. Not that I ever checked it. They didn't need to know when I did and didn't log, but that's the way to keep them safe, and I think that all of this extra freedom and trying to make them adults before they are isn't necessarily the best thing for our kids. We're supposed to be our kids' parents and our chaperones, not their friends, and I just don't think it's okay to throw them out into the social web like that. There's just too much out there that they can come into contact with when we don't have their passwords.
Tony, what are you keeping them safe from?
I'm keeping them safe from whatever they may be talking about in school that I can't control, but I can control it under my own roof. I'm keeping them safe from the extra gossip and talking about people or listening to other people talk about people with the bullying in school. I let them search the internet, but they have no computers in their rooms, and I don't feel like I am helicoptering my kids by doing that. I feel like I'm trusting them. They have computers. They have laptops. But I just don't think that there's any need to do everything on a computer. And I also think that it hurts our kids in day-to-day contact and conversation with adults. I find that a lot of kids just can't look you in the eye and have a conversation because they don't know how to socialize in person, and it's all over the internet. And I just don't think that it's always the best thing to throw them into that at an early age.
Okay. Dana, in terms of safety and teen social development and how social networking might affect them, Tony obviously has concerns and kept, online networking away from her kids.
Right. I totally hear Tony's concerns, and I think that they're very real. The challenge for teens is that they want to be a part of their peer world. When their peers are all on social media, that becomes the place to hang out. And what I've unfortunately seen is that many young people find a way of circumventing their parents, and then you end up with these ruptures that become challenging over time. Or they're talking about things without their parents understanding that they're actually engaging in bullying without their parents understanding it. And I don't suggest that parents should go and try to be friends with their kids, but it's about how do you make certain that young people are given the opportunities and freedoms and flexibilities to develop peer relationships. And that's very different than being necessarily part of every aspect of public life. And it's a delicate balance.
Does it have a negative effect on some teens' ability to socialize and develop socially if they're not interacting with people personally and only really primarily focusing with online social interactions?
There is no doubt that an online-only world is not what we want to be moving towards. But what's been intriguing to me in watching young people is that it's not the internet that is the draw for this. It's their parents' restrictions that have prompted so much of the engagement with the online to begin with.
Right.
So, if you think about the last 30 years, we've implemented curfews throughout the United States in really significant ways. The idea of getting on your bike and being home by dark is really rare in most parts of the U.S. Even if you are allowed to go out, your friends are less likely to live in close geographic proximity because of school choice and suburbanization. Your parents often work multiple jobs, which means getting access to a car is really hard. We've restricted kids' ability to get, their license in a meaningful way, so the result of which is they don't really want them because they can't get out to see them. And because of the reaction to, 1980s latchkey culture, we have overly structured kids' lives so that even if your child has the ability to get together with their friends informally, it's not likely that their friends can as well. And so we see all of these pressures. And the young people that I interviewed overwhelmingly wanted to get together with their friends in person without parental surveillance. But they found it extraordinarily difficult to do so. And so the result of which is that they turned the online because it was the only option for them. Okay. Now, what's interesting, though, is that, people often complain like, oh, kids can't socialize with adults. Kids actually are not comfortable with socializing with adults historically. This is not new. And so what I end up seeing when I spend so much time with teens is that, when they're with their friends, they're totally capable of doing face-to-face interactions to try to negotiate different, social dynamics. And then the moment their parents show up, they get on their devices and clam up. And so this is also really challenging because teenagers have not always felt comfortable with their parents, and this is nothing new. It's just now we're seeing it in a different way, and we see our interactions with our kids and fail to realize that that's not the same as their interactions with each other.
Well, we have a teenager on the line who would like to talk about this. Julia is calling from Millis. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi. So I'm actually 17 years old. Well, 17, almost 18, but I got a Facebook think I was 13 years old. And what my mom did to show me that she trusted me, she didn't take my password. She has no idea my password to social media. But either her or an aunt or a family member is friends with me on social media. So she asked me something insulting, like, say I posted something that made me seem like I was being bullied or something inappropriate on my Facebook page. She wouldn't know about it, but she wouldn't know how to talk to me about it. But she's not going on my computer and logging into my social media sites daily to check on what I'm posting, which was a really great structure for trust. And actually, I heard somebody say that parents shouldn't be their kids' friends. My mom is my best friend because she trusts me, but she's also there when I need her.
Mm-hmm. So you think that how do you think it affects the way you communicate on Facebook, knowing that your mom is friends with you on Facebook? Does it change anything?
Well, I know that, like, a lot of kids can swear a lot on Facebook or say really inappropriate things. And I mean, sometimes I get angry and I want to, you know, swear on Facebook or something. And I think, well, I don't want my mom to know that I'm doing this, and I probably shouldn't be doing this. So it makes me think twice about what I post, and it makes me be more careful and respectful.
All right. Well, Dana, what do you say to Julia? I mean, for her, it doesn't sound like it's just a place to be separate from parents and adults and to just socialize with friends.
No, I think when I say it's a place to hang out with your friends, it doesn't mean that there should be no adults ever around. I actually think that her point was fantastic because it's about those non-custodial adults that are in your life. It's the cool aunt. It's the cool uncle. It's, you know, the coach that you really like who is just like, I'm not sure that that's the best idea. Those moments can be really powerful as a way of negotiating this. And I think that's one of the things that made me really sad about, you know, this widespread message that, you know, teachers should never befriend kids on social media, or that, you know, other adults should never talk to young people. Some of the most powerful encounters I've seen with young people are with adults other than their parents. And those can be, you know, the people that are trusted and part of their community. And it's not just cool aunts. You know, one of my favorites, I'm thinking of a young woman I interviewed about how cool grandmas could be, right? Because grandmas could say anything and it was funny, right?
Well, they have a common enemy, don't they?
Exactly. But it's like, you know, mom is a different game, right? And this is where, you know, figuring out what those relationships look like. And I think it's one of the things I really advise parents to do is make certain that your children have healthy relationships with a wide variety of adults in your world, whether it's, you know, your siblings, you know, so their aunts and uncles, whether it's, you know, coaches, other people that are part of your community. They're such powerful allies as young people are coming of age.
But I think that the common perception has been that if teachers are communicating online with any of their students, that there's something unusual about that and suspect, really.
And I think that's really unfortunate because, you know, in the early days of this phenomenon, I saw a lot of really healthy encounters between young people and teachers. And I think that the advice that I've often given teachers is treat it like an open door policy like you would at school. So create an account that is just your teacher account. You're just there as a teacher. You don't go and friend students because that's sketchy. But if the students come to you, you say yes, and you turn your password to your teacher account over to your principal. And it's completely an open door policy. And this way, when young people reach out to you, you can be the supportive adult in their world, but you're not there to get in their business.
We actually have a teacher on the line. Michelle is calling from Belmont. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been listening, and I just wanted to say, you know, first of all, I think it's a great idea that, you know, we're involving other adults, but we have to be realistic that a lot of times there aren't other adults. There aren't other responsible adults. But I'm a teacher, I'm a mom, and I've also worked for years in computers. And I can honestly say a lot of parents have no idea what their kids are doing online. What you had said earlier about, you know, surveillance not being the answer, I've had lots of discussions with my students and my own children about making smart decisions online. So I certainly like to think that we have an open dialogue, but at home there is surveillance and my kids are aware of it, and I've been very clear with them about, you know, these are the things I'm going to look at online. I'll look at them with you if you want. I won't look at them behind your back, but I think surveillance in the absence of the dialogue, or dialogue in the absence of surveillance, is not useful. It's not going to be helpful. Smart kids make really silly decisions sometimes, and I've met and dealt with lots of kids who are dealing with the repercussions of some of the, you know, stupid things that 13-year-old kids do. But because they did it online, the consequences were more severe and public.
All right. Michelle, thanks very much for calling. In the last minute or so that we have left, Dana, what's the main takeaway that you would hope that folks get from your book?
My hope is that people will read this book and realize that it's time to start listening to young people, understanding what they're struggling with, what their challenges are. Things are really messy for them, and they're just trying to make it all work. And at the end of the day, it's complicated.
All right. Dana Boyd is a principal researcher at Microsoft Research, a fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Her book is titled It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens. It's being released tomorrow. She'll be signing copies at the Harvard Bookstore tomorrow night. Dana, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the dark power of fraternities, binge drinking, sexual assault, and a sophisticated system to shift the blame. I'm Deborah Becker with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.